Hello, everyone, and welcome to Politics Aren't Boring, I Promise, where I, Serena Austin, a girl who happens to get a kick out of politics and who also happens to be president of Wilfrid Laurier University Student Publications, will do a bi-weekly breakdown of the top stories in Canadian politics with Laurier professors and community members. This week, we'll learn about Brantford City Council's failed motion to support Israel in the context that's often missing from our government and media's response to conflict in the region. At the time of recording, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports that 9,488 people, including 3,900 children, have been killed in Gaza, and 2,000 others, 1,250 of which being children, are missing and presumed to be buried under the rubble. In Israel, it's reported that 1,400 people, including over 30 children, were killed by Hamas's October 7th attack, and that since Israel began their ground operation in Gaza, 28 of their soldiers have been killed. I connected with Safa Yunus, a Palestinian-Canadian and Laurier Brantford alum, and James Cairns, a professor on Laurier's Brantford campus and member of Faculty for Palestine, to hear their thoughts on this. Before we get started, I want to note that Safa and James are sharing their personal thoughts and opinions and are not intending to speak for their employers or any other organization they may be affiliated with.
First, I will go to Safa and I will let you introduce yourself and tell us a bit more about you.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Serena. My name is Safa Yunus. I am an alumni of Wilfrid Laurier University. I have my undergrad in human rights and human diversity from there. I've also completed my master's of political science from the University of Windsor. I am a child of Palestinian refugees. My grandparents fled on foot in the original 1948 Nakba. They fled northern Palestine to southern Lebanon. My grandpa lives there to this day, along with very many members of my family on my father's side, in the Ain el Helwa refugee camp.
Thank you, Safa. James, do you want to introduce yourself as well?
Sure. Thanks to both of you. And I appreciate the invitation, Serena. These are very painful, terrible times that we're living through, and it's important to gather and try to make sense of it together. So thank you for having us. I'm a professor at Laurier Brantford and have been for about 15 years. As you said, I'm speaking as an individual. I'm not representing Laurier or any other organization, but I would point out that I have written several peer-reviewed articles on Israel-Palestine since joining Laurier, and I've been active at different points in Faculty for Palestine, which is a Canada-wide network of around 800 supporters, participating in campaigns for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel for its illegal occupation and apartheid system in historic Palestine. And I more broadly do my research and teaching around political culture, social movements, theories of democracy, and that's where I'm coming at this from.
Well, thank you. So I guess before we kind of dive into the Brantford aspect of the story, Safa, I just wanted to ask, I guess, to check in how you are doing, how your family is doing. Obviously, this is very harrowing times, and there are a lot of Palestinian Canadians who are affected. So I would love to hear from you.
Thank you for that question, Serena. I don't want to be overly emotional at the start of this. Obviously, it's been a very, very difficult time for those in the Palestinian community, those in diaspora, those witnessing the ongoing genocide. We are trying our best to lean on each other, to lean on allies in our community. I really don't have words to say about what it is I'm feeling. This is not normal to be witnessing a genocide through our screens in real time without any filters or any edits. As of right now, I don't really have any words, but I thank you for your question.
That's understandable. Absolutely.
I just want to thank Safa and really honor and appreciate her contribution. I mean, the bravery it takes to be here as we're watching this genocide unfold, and the honesty about the effect that it's having on people, for me, is refreshing and very humane contribution to a media and mainstream political discourse that often feels inhumanely sanitized about what we're really dealing with.
Yeah, and it seems like that's kind of the case for people in Brantford who are kind of realizing that and were wanting to show support a few weekends ago by protesting in support of a free Palestine. And that kind of led to, in city council, a motion to support Israel was voted down after all these protests and after citizens spoke out about how they really felt about the issue. And I know, James, that you were present in that meeting. So can you talk a little bit about what happened in city council?
I think it's important to understand that earlier in October, a Brantford City Councillor, Dan McCreary, moved what was called a resolution in support of the State of Israel at a committee of council that included all councillors. It was a pre-council meeting that sort of puts things on the agenda. And the resolution, in part, grieved the lives of Israelis killed during the Hamas operation of October 7th, but said nothing about the deaths or suffering of Palestinians, nothing about the conditions of life under 75 years of occupation, and nothing about the siege, the complete siege of Gaza, cutting off food, water, electricity, medicine, announced on October 9th. The resolution also urged the Canadian government to fund the Israeli military and promised to fly the flag of Israel or beam the colors of the Israeli flag on City Hall indefinitely. And so the motion was unanimously approved by councillors at that time, and it was scheduled then to be voted on October 24th. And so what happened over those weeks was that the Palestinian, Muslim, and Arab community in Brantford and the area built a campaign to stop the resolution. And there was a very moving open letter written by Nasser Hamed, who is the president of the mosque and the Palestinian Association. It culminated in the Hands Off Gaza rally in front of City Hall on Sunday the 22nd, and then a large delegation at the meeting. I mean, there was hundreds of people at the rally, speeches against the resolution, documenting Israel's long history of crimes against Palestinians and the current genocidal war. And then at council on the 24th, there were dozens and dozens of people from the community in the colors of the Palestinian flag, in keffiyehs, and one speaker after another got in front of council and explained why the resolution is so harmful. It's misrepresentative of the actual situation. It's cruel for ignoring the Palestinian community. It fans the flames of anti-Arab racism and Islamophobia. And, I mean, I was proud to be one of the speakers submitting a letter against a resolution on behalf of 27 Laurier Brantford faculty members. But the wisdom of the speakers with experience of life in Israel-Palestine, from Nasser talking about his own family's experience of ethnic cleansing, to a man whose sister was killed by an Israeli airstrike days earlier in Gaza, to a rabbi who had lived in Israel for years and who fiercely condemned the Israeli state. It was a true, extremely powerful education for council and for me, and I think for lots of people there. I mean, council tried to soften the resolution initially, but it was just clear that the community there would stand for nothing short of revoking it. And in the end, the motion was defeated 10-1. So, you know, there is no happiness while Israel's genocide continues, but it was a small win. It was a good thing that the community defeated the motion, and it was good that council listened. I think it was good that it understood that it was wrong and changed its mind.
I've personally seen like a lot of media coverage. I feel it's kind of polarized to how many communities feel about what's going on in Palestine and the violence that is being unleashed. There have been massive protests, not even just like in Canada and in the GTA, but globally. So as you say, there is no true happiness. Like there's a dark cloud hanging over all of this and why all of this is happening. But how does seeing that support and seeing people wearing keffiyehs and things like that impact you?
I mean, the narratives are beginning to shift, and we are seeing that. Social media has a large role to play in that, thankfully. There's no longer a bias of a reporter filtering what we are seeing. We are seeing it being recorded from those living it on the ground. So seeing this tide sort of shift has been giving us hope, because we understand that our fellow Canadians, our fellows across the world, in all different countries, see what is happening and are not standing for the atrocities. whether or not the heads of state listen to those that have democratically elected them and accept the application of equal international law, of application of equal international law, which is what we are demanding. Until then, this gives us some hope, but that is really what we're aiming for.
Right. That's what matters the most.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of students, I suspect this is kind of the first time that for those who are removed from the issue are like having to tune in and having to pay attention, maybe even to like this part of the world in general. So I was hoping that we could provide some historical context and also geographical context as to where Palestinians are located in the world. Where is the land of Palestine that is currently being occupied?
Historic Palestine sits on the eastern part of the Mediterranean. If you're picturing where that is, you know, south of Turkey, bordered by Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt to the south. And then, you know, as far as how to describe where is Israel in the occupied territories, I think it's worth pointing out to start with that Israel does not have internationally recognized borders. You know, the state of Israel was never conceded by Palestinians. This is why you have decades of armed struggle against Israeli colonialism, including the Hamas operation on October 7th. The indigenous Palestinian population forced off the land, never agreed to it, always promised to return, refused to accept the theft of their own homelands. So, I mean, what is the main part of Israel? Roughly the area declared Israel in 1948 by the UN, plus 60% of the lands that were dedicated to an Arab state at the time, which Israel captured in the 1948 war and never returned, as well as the Gaza Strip, which is a small area of land to the sort of southwest of Israel's 1948 borders, 40 kilometers long, 6 to 12 kilometers wide. I mean, we're talking about a very small, densely populated strip of land. And then the West Bank, a much larger area of land, 5,000 square kilometers bordered by the Jordan River to its east, 3 million plus people, including 500,000 Jewish settlers who are living in the West Bank illegally on settlements that are in violation of international law. You can't occupy, you can't settle land that you are militarily occupying according to the Geneva Convention. And the West Bank is cut through with a huge wall built by Israel in 2000 that badly disrupts Palestinian life and steals or encroaches another 12% of the territory that Israel occupied in 1967. Because the final thing I'll say, sorry, and then Safa will want to jump in, is that the West Bank and Gaza are the occupied territories because they were militarily occupied by Israel in 1967 and have never been liberated. They remain under Israeli military law. They're not sovereign states. They don't have their own borders. They are not, those citizens are not Palestinian citizens with the full rights of an international passport that others have in other lands. They're refugees that have been pushed out of Israel in the ethnic cleansing in the Nakba of 1948, many of them, I mean, other than the people who were originally there.
Yes, thank you, James, for providing sort of the descriptor of what historic Palestine is and what is currently on historic Palestine, which is the state of Israel, which I would like to state is a settler colonial project, a continued settler colonial project that the Europeans seem to have deemed to be an Arab and Palestinian problem now because, I need to catch my breath, I'm sorry, but this is just a really sensitive issue for me, of course. My family has faced displacement, as I mentioned earlier in the conversation, in 1948. And as I was saying to James before, the reason why I was able to study in Laurier-Brantford and did not end up in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip, or in the occupied West Bank is just by chance the direction that my grandparents fled. That is the only difference between myself and those living in Gaza. So when people ask, oh, do you have family in Gaza? Is that why you're so affected? No, every Palestinian is me, and I am every Palestinian. I deeply feel the hurt, the pain, the anguish that every Palestinian is feeling right now. So I'm having a bit of a hard time collecting my words and expressing that right now. But I would just like to say that this is the land of peace. Jerusalem is the land of peace. And that it is a significant location for all three of the Abrahamic faiths. It has historically been able to house peacefully all three of these Abrahamic faiths. And I believe it can once again, under a one-state solution with equal rights for all and international rights applied equally to all. That is just something I need to share, yes.
Safa, can I just jump in on something that Safa said, Serena?
Please do.
I just think that Safa's framing of Israel as a settler colony, as a project of settler colonialism is really important and something that people in Canada actually may be well-placed to better understand, because Canada is a settler colony and a European settler colonial project. It's in a different phase than Israel presently, and we can talk about that if you want, but I think the character of how Canada sees many people in Canada see the situation, both those who align themselves with, I think, out of a sense of camaraderie or guilt or something with the settler colonial project of Israel, as well as critics and indigenous anti-colonial activists in Canada, like Leanne Betasemasake Simpson, are leading voices against the Israeli occupation and of Palestine. So, in 1917, as the Ottoman Empire was falling at the end of World War I, the British took over historic Palestine in the classic case of European colonialism and pledged to create a Jewish homeland there for a variety of reasons. And I should name all of them being British self-interested geopolitical reasons, namely wanting to keep a military and political dominance in its empire extended, as long as possible. But at that time, historic Palestine was 90% Arab Muslim. It is absolutely the case, and I'm glad, to hear Safa speak about it is so beautiful, is that this has always been a place for a variety of people from a variety of different ethnicities and religions. There's always been Jews, Christians, and Muslims there, but it was predominantly a Muslim Arab state, and it was a designed policy of settling Jews from Europe there en masse for decades that led to a situation by 1945, 1948, when there are still far more, a million plus Muslims, 135,000 Christians, but at that point, 553,000 Jews in the area. But the Zionist project, creating a Jewish state in historic Palestine, has always been resisted by Palestinians because it was displacement, land theft, occupation. But the partition plan that the UN proposed was going to hand 56% of the land to a Jewish state, which was something like 30% of the population at the time in the region. And armed resistance to partition by Palestinian militias and Arab armies, at the moment of Israel's creation, refused to accept the terms of such an unequal, unfair theft of land and displacement of political sovereignty. I mean, that's the history that is crucial to understanding the context in the present moment.
I agree. Right. Yeah, I feel I've seen most countries in their discourse about Palestine and Israel, kind of the furthest they will go is to call for a two-state solution. And as you've touched on, due to pure numbers of popularity, that doesn't really make sense. And in my eyes, it makes sense why Palestinians would not accept that, would not accept becoming the minority in a place where that has never really been true. So what does, if you're able to elaborate on it more, what would the one state solution look like?
Simply put, it would look like the lift of the siege on Gaza, which has been besieged for decades now. Lifting that siege, allowing food and water and fuel into the land there, allowing the people who some children have never seen the world outside of that wall, outside of that apartheid wall, allowing them the opportunity to see the world, to travel, to have sovereignty over their land, to have communal ownership over their land, traditionally, how it has been in the past, to have that connection to the land. As we speak right now, while the world is watching what is happening in Gaza, in the West Bank, armed settlers that have been armed by the Israeli government, are going in and displacing whole neighborhoods, cutting down olive trees, the Palestinian connection with the olive trees, and it is now the beginning of olive harvest. It is very critical what they're doing, and they are very intentional about this ethnic cleansing and genocide at every step. While the world is watching, they are kidnapping fathers and sons, stripping them naked, dragging them through the streets. I'm watching footage of this from the diaspora, watching almost through a glass window. What we're asking for is an end to all of this, an end to all of this, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. Everything, every Palestinian, every person living there deserves and is entitled to equal rights, just as every Jewish person is, just as every Christian person is on that land. That is all we are asking for. The safety of Jewish people should not come at the cost of Palestinian lives. That is what we are asking for. That is what a free Palestine would look like.
Thank you, Safa. I want to elaborate on what some of the terms that we're using are, because I feel like people who are disinterested will kind of use those as a way to dismiss what we're saying. We kind of touched on settler colonialism and the ties to Canadian history in that sense. But things like ethnic cleansing and genocide have very specific definitions. So can we talk about those and how that applies to Palestinians?
I know that there are 5 United Nations genocide conventions that Israel is currently breaching right now. The 3 that come to mind is 1, the killing members of the group, which Israel has explicitly stated they intend to do, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, which they again are doing, and importantly, deliberately inflicting on the group, quote, conditions of life calculated to bring about physical destruction in whole or in part. We are witnessing that happening before our eyes for the past 27 days.
That's really useful, Safa. I've been thinking about the term as well. But just a note on ethnic cleansing, because you mentioned that as well, Serena. And I found myself thinking a lot about an interview that I heard with the Rutgers University professor, Palestinian-American Noura Erekat recently. And anybody who's interested in knowing more about the history and current political situation, I cannot recommend her analysis more highly. And she's been on the Dig podcast lately a few different times on the Palestine Teach-In, and that's a place to go. But, you know, I mean, when you hear this talk about ethnic cleansing and you know, not a Nakba, a second Nakba, I mean, Nakba in Arabic means a catastrophe. The Nakba is the formalization of the state of Israel, which is the dispossession of Arab and Palestinians from their homelands. And so just for listeners, if this isn't clear, I mean, in 1948, Zionist militias and then the Israeli army on the creation of Israel, you know, kills something like 10,000 or 12,000 Palestinians, and then forcibly displaces 750,000 to 800,000 Palestinians out of Israel into the West Bank and Gaza. I mean, this is, people talk about refugee camps in Gaza, where are they refugees from? They're refugees from Israel in 1948 or 67, you know, depending. And then what Noura Erekat is saying is that, and as something Safa pointed out earlier, the Nakba is ongoing. It is like all settler colonial states, a constant expansion, constant land grabs through illegal settlements, through home demolitions, through forced removal, and, you know, certainly the expulsion of a million people from one end of Gaza to the other under impossible conditions, as well as the leveling of refugee camps over the last 3 weeks, you know, is not just reminiscent, but a continuation of policies of ethnic cleansing that have been at the heart of Israeli policy since its inception. With respect to genocide, I really like the formal definitions. I didn't have those at hand, Safa, but in a really powerful article by the Israeli historian of modern genocide, Raz Segal, in Jewish Currents recently, he says this is a, quote, textbook case of genocide. you know, what is genocide? It's a deliberate killing of a large number of a specific group or nation, the targeted mass murder, attempt to eliminate a people in whole or in part. And so, you know, the complete siege of Gaza, cutting off all food, water, electricity, and medical supplies, the forced displacement of 1 million people, the constant bombing. You know, Israel has dropped the equivalent of a nuclear bomb on Gaza in the first 3 weeks of the war. Tens of thousands of bombs, you know, bombing hospitals, bombing churches, bombing mosques, bombing roads, bombing areas in the south that Gazans have been told to flee to. Bombing the Jabalia refugee camp 3 times in the last 3 days, one of the most densely populated areas in Gaza, killing hundreds. 9,000 people, 9,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israel since October 7th, more than 3,500 of them children. You know, UNICEF, the children's agency of the UN, calls Gaza a graveyard for children. One after another leader of global human rights organizations says this is a massacre of stunning proportions, mass slaughter, genocide. And then the other piece that stands out to me, and this was something that was mentioned by the UN rights commissioner that resigned yesterday because of the protest of the UN's inaction, is his saying not only is there the genocidal actions taking place, but the genocidal logic, the genocidal intent is being made crystal clear by the leaders of the Israeli army and political apparatus. You have Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, saying, quote, we're fighting human animals. I mean, using animalistic language against enemies is a telltale sign of genocidal policy. Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, talking about the children of light against the children of darkness, doing the work of God. In his speech on the weekend, Netanyahu said, as God instructed the Israelites to do to Amalek in Samuel 15:3 in the Bible. I mean, what is that story in the Bible? It's about God's command to the Israelites to completely annihilate, exterminate a warring, an enemy population that attacks them. God says to the Israelites, now go and smite Amalek, utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. This is a call for total extermination. And we're seeing that play out. I mean, those logics, those instructions, those visions are being put into action, as Safa says, in front of our eyes. And it is appalling. I can't believe that we're sitting here as the world allows this to happen. Canada votes against a UN call for a ceasefire last week. Disgusting. It's shameful. It's complicit in genocide. I mean, how many more Palestinian deaths does Justin Trudeau and the Canadian government need to see before this is enough?
I do feel like the narrative that most of our leaders have taken from October 7th to now has kind of shifted. In some cases, it has absolutely shifted. In the case of NDP MPP Sarah mm-hmm. Jama, who is kicked from caucus, the Ontario NDP is now also calling for a ceasefire, which is, they say, is not the reason why she was kicked from caucus, but it's arguable. So how has media coverage of this issue left you feeling? I definitely have a lot of feelings about it. How do you guys feel?
I mean, it's definitely difficult to collect my thoughts on how this has left me feeling. Definitely does not come as a surprise. As somebody with lived experience as a Palestinian living in Canada and who has come to reckon with the fact that I am a settler here as well, by the same entity and forces that have displaced my ancestors is the same ones that have displaced the original and indigenous people of North America and Turtle Island, right? So understanding that and then viewing the media and its coverage of Palestine really, it gives me a different sort of lens, because I understand that it is of the interest of the Canadian state to protect the settler colonial entity that is Israel. Because if not, what does that say about the project that we are underway here and where our role is here? You know, we as Canadians have the duty, or as settlers have the duty to be in community with the Indigenous people around us, to understand what it is that they are wanting. And when I look at those in the Ontario NDP or in or politicians generally calling for a quote humanitarian pause, as if nourishing the bodies that will then be destroyed once that pause is finished, once you hit play again, is beyond disgusting, is beyond disgusting to me. And but again, it does not come as a surprise. We, Justin Trudeau, we have sent Israeli soldiers back to fight. We have flown them out from Canada using Canadian tax dollars. We are signing trades and arms deals with Israel. We are benefiting from the genocide of Palestinians, whether or not we like to admit that. We are complicit, as much as we like to look to our neighbors to the south and, you know, wash our hands of everything. Canada is just as complicit in this ethnic cleansing, in this ongoing ethnic cleansing and genocide. And we as settlers and we as those who live on this land have to come to grasps with that and come to understandings with that. And how do we move forward? James?
I mean, I was enjoying listening to you speak. I think as far as media coverage goes, kind of the point that you make that resonates with me, Safa, is a little bit like, this isn't surprising, right? I mean, we know this is how the media, the mainstream corporate media covers things. Greg Shupak has a good book about, you know, the way in which professional norms and corporate complicity with Israeli apartheid represents the situation problematically. There still is just a few things that I just see in the media, and I just can't believe it. I mean, anytime that there is a report that allows someone to say Israel has the right to self-defense as long as it's within humanitarian law, and then doesn't immediately say, and yet Israel has been in violation of international law at every moment of its most recent assault, as well as every moment of the last 75 years. I mean, that seems to me to be an awful abrogation of sort of providing the full truth to the situation. The fact that people, again, the media is a place where there is a constant repetition of this idea of Israel's right to self-defense, and yet there is never a discussion of the fact that there is no such thing as a right to self-defense against occupied people living within a state's borders. I mean, the occupied territories are not sovereign. In fact, according to the Geneva Conventions, Israel has an obligation, a right, a responsibility to protect and to care for people living under Israeli occupation. You know, the idea that the way that mainstream media starts the clock on this on October 7th and fails to put into the picture the fact that Gaza has been under Israeli blockade for the past 16 years, you know, erases the 75-year resistance against ethnic cleansing and occupation. That just seems like, you know, that this can be reported on without focusing on the system of passes and checkpoints that are the daily experience of humiliation and immobility of people within the West Bank. The fact that there are 6,000 prisoners, 500 children, some as young as 12 detained and prosecuted in Israel's military system every year. You know, these are left out of the stories about captives, that there are 6,000 Palestinian captives inside Israeli prisons. It's just a stunning failure of telling the whole story. And so I guess the only thing I would say to add about this and is that while there certainly is important coverage to get from mainstream corporate media, and I do read The Guardian every day, and I do follow Al Jazeera, most of my media coverage I get from non-corporate independent sources. So Democracy Now! Is good as a daily venue for news and analysis. Jadalia, 972 magazine, Palestinians on social media. So Noura Erekat, Remy Kenazi, The Dig podcast, Jewish Currents, The London Review of Books, N+1. I mean, Safa, maybe you have other specific people or venues to follow, but like that's where we need to go to get an understanding of the situation, because it's not going to be in the Globe and Mail.
I agree. There are also those on the ground, as James had said, one of them being Martha Azaiza. There's also Palestia. There's Yara Eid. These are youth who were living their lives as best they could under besiegement and occupation, making the best of it, and who have now become journalists who have turned their, who are charging their phones using car batteries because fuel is no longer allowed, and who are doing their best to stream this genocide to us, screaming into the void, it seems, because there is there is no response that has been yet given to end this, to end the atrocities. So I would recommend following their accounts, although Meta has done everything they can to suppress those voices and accounts through algorithms. We know this. There are also different forms of media you can consume. I personally would feel like I should mention that my cousin has made a film called A World Not Ours. It is available on Netflix. It tells the story of our family in the refugee camp, how we got there, what that life has been since they've arrived there. And of course, many things have happened since its filming. But there are many, many different sources, as well as the film called Tantura, T-A-N-T-U-R-A, discusses a massacre of the village, the sea town of Tantura, by Zionist militias, making way for the state of Israel. I would just recommend broadening your consumption and not relying so heavily on these mainstream sources.
Absolutely. Thank you both for sharing those resources. We've kind of already talked about Canada's history and Safa, as you mentioned, the reasons why it seems Canada is so bent on supporting Israel, which I've also been thinking about, and how they have historically fathered these ideas. People call Israel an apartheid state, and apartheid from South Africa was inspired by Canada's treatment of Indigenous people in residential schools. So it may seem like, to some people, like a false equivalency, but can you talk more about how that's not the case?
I would just like to say that it is very much the same playbook. It is the same playbook that has been used in South Africa. Certainly, the arms that were used by the Boers to resist against the Indigenous Africans were supplied by Israel as well, I should mention. So these settler colonial projects are very much entwined and indeed reliant on the support of one another to maintain their legitimacy, firstly, and then their continuation.
I would just extend the point that you're making, Safa, to say that we're told that by leaders of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Nelson Mandela, Ronnie Casserles, and others, they say, we lived through it, we resisted it, we've been to Israel, Palestine. This is exactly the situation that we're in. And in fact, these are Tutu's words, not mine. The situation is worse. I've heard them say the situation in Palestine is really worse, the apartheid system. And so I guess I just think that Safa puts it so nicely by saying it is the same playbook, different contexts, different historical periods, different phases of the project. But apartheid as a formal term defining a particular kind of state that is institutionalized segregation, a system of government in which one group is systematically privileged, protected, rewarded through the other group being oppressed, exploited, and harmed by design. The classic case of the term is South Africa, and it is the South African leadership of the anti-apartheid struggle that has been a part of helping to develop the analysis of apartheid Israel along with Palestinian scholars and activists over decades. So, could say more about what that looks like in Israel Palestine, but I think that the idea that this is the same playbook is important. Important also that that's why one of the largest nonviolent civil society-based movements against Israeli apartheid since 2005 has been the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS against Israeli apartheid, which is looking at the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa as a model for putting pressure on Israel to abide by international law. And I'll just note the many times we've heard people ask how come there needs to be, or why won't Palestinians give up armed resistance? Hamas is going about this the wrong way, and surely there are other forms of resistance that would work better, needs to reckon with the fact that every attempt at nonviolent resistance to Israeli occupation and apartheid has been met with violence, censorship, and the state-sanctioned attempt to dismantle networks of anti-apartheid activists. And so BDS law, there are anti-BDS laws in 37 US states. The definition of anti-Semitism, which includes criticism of the state of Israel, supported by the conservative government in Ontario, as well as others in the Canadian federal state. The fact that the Great March of Return, which saw Gazans marching to the wall, to the apartheid fence, separating Israel from Gaza, a peaceful demonstration, thousands of people marching to show their demand, their commitment to return to their homelands, are shot at by Israeli strike snipers from 300 meters away, killing 200, injuring thousands. This is what happens to nonviolent resistance in this moment. And I think that we see parallels with the harsh crackdown on anti-apartheid activism in South Africa as well.
Thank you for adding that context. That's definitely really important to consider. Before we wrap up, you mentioned BDS movement. I've seen a lot of like crowdfunding, but I'm not super sure how effective that is due to like support not being allowed into Palestine. So what can people who support a free Palestine in Canada, whether they're a student listener or a community member, what can they do meaningfully to show that support?
I would take my lead from the Palestinian voices that I follow on social media and in my personal networks, who are saying what we need right now is mass mobilization in the streets, campaigns to put pressure on MPs, public education, consciousness raising, anything and everything you can do to campaign for a ceasefire now, an end of the siege of Gaza, and unhindered humanitarian aid into Gaza, campaigns for full Palestinian rights. I mean, so whether it's on your campus, it's in your union, your church, your mosque, your Black Lives Matter chapter, your arts organization, trying to bring people together and to put collective pressure on decision makers to call for a ceasefire now and break ties with Israeli apartheid. I mean, that generally seems to me to be the framework for thinking about how to act in this moment. I think seeking guidance from local Palestinian solidarity groups that are rooted in Palestinian Muslim and Arab communities is important. For me, it's work with Faculty for Palestine, committed to BDS, pressing for Israel to abide by international law by ending the occupation, recognizing full rights for Arab citizens inside Israel, and honoring the right of return for refugees, which is enshrined by the United Nations Resolution 181.
I think I would just add, everything that James has said is exactly what the Palestinian voices are asking for. We are asking, as James has said, for consciousness awareness, for pushes for those who are representing us in government to understand that the will of the people is not to continue the occupation of the Palestinian people. We would like to see a liberated Palestine. We would like to see Palestinians living free. And it is our responsibility as fellow human beings and as fellow citizens of the world to educate ourselves and to advocate for these rights. I do this, of course, because I am Palestinian, but firstly, because I am a human being, and I cannot stand by and watch the onslaught of people, regardless of what you would like to call them, whether you call them Palestinians or group A, B, or C. Regardless, these are human beings and they are fully deserving of rights. They have tried every avenue, every political avenue, every peaceful, nonviolent avenue. And this is regretfully what it has come to. And it is very upsetting that this is what happens to have the conversation going and for us to discuss it at the cost of thousands of lives and the displacement of millions. Mm. But I do have hope that this will come to an end, because this kind of injustice cannot continue forever. I have to have that hope.
Thank you both so much for sharing. Before I let you go, is there anything else that either of you would like to add?
You know, as far as standing up and putting pressure on and joining campaigns for ceasefire and so on, I don't want to come across as though I'm saying that that's easy. I recognize that I certainly speak from a position of power as a tenured professor, as a white Canadian man with citizenship. I do not face the vulnerability that most people face in all kinds of different ways. And people need to make decisions about how they're best able to contribute according to their levels of security, comfort, et cetera. But the situation is urgent and high stakes. And I think opportunities to support Free Palestine are going to widen in the coming days and years. And when I look, but when you look at what the Palestinian youth movement is able to pull into the streets day after day, night after night, pressing for change, when you look at Jewish Voice for Peace occupying Grand Central Station, independent Jewish voices in Canada occupying MPs' offices, and we're days, only days out from the beginning of this assault, I, like Safa, am inspired and have to hope that these mobilizations will build, grow, and lead to the justice and peace that is so long overdue. Thanks, Serena. Okay. Thanks, Safa.
Thank you both. Yeah, thank you. Thank you both so much for doing this interview. I know we went way over our original planned time, but I'm really, really grateful that you both agreed to do this. I feel like I learned a lot, and it was really invaluable hearing from you, Safa.
Thank you, Serena. And thank you, James, as well, for inviting me to speak with you, and Serena for having us both.
That's all for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Serena Austin, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Politics Aren't Boring, I promise.